Welcome to Friday Free Talk Live for November 16th. I'm your host for tonight, Bud White. Joining me shortly will be my co-host for tonight, Signet. Tell us a little bit about that.
Now, James Browning has prepared something he calls the Ron Paul Minute for us tonight.
Okay, so everybody, I'm going to play this now. No need to mute. Just be quiet for a few seconds.
And now, a celebration of diversity for my VNN listeners on this holiday season.
Nigga chink wop wop hunky hunky nigga chink wop wop Jew Jew nigga chink wop wop hunky Jew nigga chink wop wop Jew nigga chink wop wop jungle bunny nigga chink wop wop Jew Jew nigga chink wop wop jungle bunny nigga chink wop wop hick.
For our VNN listeners, let me lower that. Our heathen VNN listeners, according to majority rights there. But,
you know, James, you know what that reminded me of? Have you ever heard facade, James, which is like a spoken word thing from the 1920s?
No.
Anyways, it reminded me of that. Go on.
Yeah,
and now, James Bowery with the Ron Paul Minute.
Okay, here we go with the Ron Paul Minute. Basically, the big news that nobody is paying attention to, but they really should, is that Ron Paul has been now shown to be the most electable of the GOP field by a very strong metric. That metric is the betting odds at the Intrade.com gambling site. Now, the way that this works is if you look at the Intrade odds for Ron Paul being nominated, it's only around something like 8%. And if you look at the Intrade odds for Ron Paul being president, in other words, not only getting the nomination, but then successfully campaigning for president, it's around something like 2 or 3%. What you do to get what's called the electability is you divide the odds of Ron Paul being elected president by the odds of Ron Paul being nominated to president. And that gives you another probability. That's his electability.
In other words, what website is this again? What website
listeners... You can look at the analysis via Majority Rights. And there's a story that I put up on Majority Rights about this that references a story on VDare that was published a while back.
Okay.
The title of this story on Majority Rights is Intrade Betting Odds Now Say Ron Paul is Most Electable Republican. And I'll basically just read off. It's a very short article. I'll just read off what it says, okay? The gamblers of the world are putting their money where their mouths are, and their money is saying that Ron Paul is the most electable of the Republican field. Dividing the Intrade odds of being elected president by the odds of getting the nomination for the Republican Party, Randall Burns at VDare blogs that the most electable Republican candidate is Ron Paul. The rank order of electability is as follows. Paul has 43.2%, Thompson 41.9%, Huckabee 40.8%, Giuliani 40.3%, McCain 38.6 and Romney 36.2. For those who don't understand how this quote Bayesian end quote calculation of electability works, just think of it like this. Imagine we can run elections with a set of candidates the way we roll dice. Electability is the number of times a candidate gets elected to be president per the number of times the candidate is nominated by his party to run for president. So basically what this is saying is the people who are putting their money where their mouths are, and we're not talking about political hypesters that are out there concocting polls or pundits that are spinning stories or any of the rest of that crap, okay? We're talking about the system that has the track record of most accurately predicting what's going to happen in actual elections is the gambling or the what's called the prediction markets. And the prediction markets right now say that if Ron Paul is elected, then among the Republican field, he has the best chance of being reelected. However, he does not have a very good chance of being nominated at present for some strange reason that has something to do with the Republican Party not really being serious about getting the presidency or holding on to seats in Congress on the coattails of the presidency. So that's the story for tonight, basically.
So according to the gambling sites, based upon their probability, looks like he's at a 43% and the rest of the field is pretty close behind him, but he is definitely out front.
He's out front.
Inelectability, which is not a chance of winning.
Right. In other words, if the Republicans were to get serious about winning the election, then he would be the guy that they would pick. But they aren't serious about winning. There's something wrong with their brains, or there's some other agenda going on.
I'm not even paying attention to the popular polls. Who do they have out front? Is Giuliani as far as Republican?
Yeah, Giuliani's out front of the popular polls. But you know, the thing about the popular polls is, you got these guys. Basically, during the entire 20th century, okay, you've had this big centralized mass media, which has primarily been controlled by Jews, and they don't really have the ethics to understand that when you go out and you poll the population, especially early in an election, if you want democracy to work, representative democracy, a federal republic to work, what you have to do is you have to try to match up people with positions and then match those positions with various candidates and tend to bias your reporting toward what the people are demanding in terms of candidates that hold the positions reflective of the people. A dating service between the people and the candidates early on, so that you get the possibility of people being represented. What they do instead is they ask people to come up with names, basically, who have you heard of from us? And then the people say, well, we've heard of Giuliani from you. And then the media says, well, I guess that must mean Giuliani's going to be the next president because we've been talking about him a lot. And that's why the Ron Paul people hate the media. And
the media hates the Ron Paul people.
Yeah. It's mutually assured hate here.
Hey, guess what? I've been gathering signatures to put Ron Paul on the Illinois primary ballot. I've gotten like 19 so far.
And that's much needed.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's the basic idea of the Ron Paul Minute. I can talk a little bit about why Ron Paul is important to white nationalists, but if you don't
want
to hear
that,
that's fine.
Well, we got time. We're not going to end the broadcast for probably close to another 4 hours, so we got a few minutes. Why don't you go over that?
Okay. basically, the reason Ron Paul is important for white nationalists is that right now, what white nationalists need more than anything else is the ability to escape from this horrendous imposition of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Essentially, if you look at all of the violations that are most egregious to whites, they're violations of our freedom of association. They're basically a bunch of Bayesian and Frankfurt School hypotheses and human organization that have been put forth. And those hypotheses are then turned into experiments in human ecology, basically, you know, how you organize humans together over a territory. And those hypotheses and experiments are being imposed on experimental subjects like you and I who have never consented to those things. And so we're basically, you know, they talk a lot about Dr. Mengele and, you know, the Jews and stuff like that. Well, you know, they're conducting human experimentation on us without our consent. And so what we really need is to be able to get control of the experiments in which we participate. Some of us have differences. Some of us would allow certain kinds of drugs. Some of us would allow abortion. Some of us would disallow abortion, et cetera, and I think that, you know, we need to provide a lot of diversity of choice in those areas. But the fundamental thing that they absolutely will not allow under any circumstance is the ability of people to basically live in environments that are ethnically similar to those in which they grew up. And because they just don't want to conduct that kind of experiment on themselves and their children. And it's like, well, Jews say, well, no, you have to conduct this experiment because it's evil for you to not conduct the experiment. So now watch us do this to you and your children. And that's really where Ron Paul comes in with his opposition. I don't know if you saw the who's that, Jackie Mason, the Jewish comedian? He has a video on YouTube lambasting Ron Paul because Ron Paul opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And, you know, he said, oh, well, you don't want to bring back slavery, blah, blah, blah. And really what Ron Paul is opposed to is this whole idea of violating individual choice about association. And, of course, it goes beyond that. But and there's a lot of things that will have to be confronted eventually in this whole liberation of the white people who don't want to participate in these you know, very risky experiments in human ecology. But at the present point in time, the most powerful thing that we can do is try to put into place somebody who basically just takes back money from these redistribution programs that are enforcing on us these experiments at the federal level. So did you understand that?
I understood that completely, yeah. He's, you know, the sad truth is if he ever got close, and people have mentioned this, if he ever got close, if it ever looked like he was winning, they'd kill him.
I think he's fully aware of that. You know, the thing is that this guy has 18 grandchildren. His genes are safe, okay? So, you know, he's 72 years old. This is his last chance really to do anything. And I think that he would be quite happy to die well in that way. So, you know, there are a lot of areas in which I disagree with Dr. Paul's positions. I think that, you know, he's going to be making a lot of Jews very rich and basically shifting from the centralized sort of communist style of centralized wealth to the, you know, capitalist style of centralized wealth in which Jews have typically excelled when they are provided protection of their property rights on the blood of policemen and military men, and the taxes of the rest of us who can't really afford even our own houses. But it's a step in the right direction, and any kind of step in that direction at this point in time, according to Machiavelli, if you read his discourses or The Prince, it's the kind of thing where if a tyrant waits until there is an outside threat to his power to try to assist his people in being able to afford to have children, anything he does to appease his people or to help his people is attributed by his people not to his own generosity, but rather to the liberation of the opposing force. So at the present time, over the last generation, with our people being unable to even have children in our cities and these oppressive mortgages and unstable families and unstable jobs, etc., and the demographic collapse and the race replacement that's going on. This is just a horrendous tyranny we're under. And at this point, we're having things like, you know, the Islamics coming in, and then we have Ron Paul coming on the other side, and there's guys like VNN, etc. You know, there are these opposition forces basically being empowered by the internet and alternate ways of getting information to people. And they really are between a rock and a hard place now, just like the tyrant in Machiavelli's story. So it's very important to try to loosen up the thumbscrews a little bit on the people, even if it's not going to get everything, because any kind of loosening of the thumbscrews at this point is going to be, the credit for that is going to be given to the opposition. And so that's one of the big things Ron Paul does.
Yeah,
that's great, James.
Yeah, that's.
Bud, I thought you would really like this guy.
He's an excellent speaker. I've just gotten some feedback here from our, signing agent here, our talent agent for VNN Broadcasting, which is Mark and Callie, a.k.a. Mishko Novosel. He said, sign him up. Let's get a contract on this guy. So,
I just wondered, I saw Alex came online. I don't know if you want to bring him in at some point. I hope he comes in. But I was thinking before that, if we could all three of us talk about, you know, my whole thing about my insecurity and narcissism, and you know how, like, we always have to talk about me a little bit, or I get, like, anxious?
Okay, yeah, I'm kind of getting that vibe from you, yeah. Okay, go ahead. You're not a modest guy, Signet. I'll tell you that much. You're not a modest guy.
No, that was a joke.
Okay.
But anyway, the point is, James, you saw the video interrupted conversation, right?
The video interrupted conversation?
Yeah, that was the video I took at the Academic Freedom Conference at University of Chicago.
Oh, yes, of
course. Which was interrupted by that woman. And I think I had Bud watch it. So I thought we could all talk about it. Because Panzerfaust really loved it when I had him look at it. And I was just, you know, I was thinking we could talk about that, and I could bathe in the reflected glory of that video for one more week before I have to go out and shoot something else and, you know, like, do something else.
Milk it, baby.
Yeah, so what did you think about, what did you think it showed that was important? Did you notice when she said, you don't have my permission to use this footage?
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
And I said, you came up on us when I was filming a conversation in public at a public event, and now you're telling me I can't use it? And you interrupted?
Yeah, well, you know, she was fulfilling her sort of, what's the term for it? Owl parenting skills.
Okay.
You're sitting there getting a bad boy, and she had to come up and parent you, you know. And then you were going to be a worse boy by filming her, and she was going to correct you on that. And basically, what happens, I really think that one of the things that happens with the Jewish group organism is that there are, you know, some certain subset of Jews, and I don't know what the percentage is, but I think there's some set of genes that get activated in some subset that put them into parental ego state in inappropriate times and places, so that, and you know, parents can be rather irrational with their children, because a lot of times what they're doing is they're trying to convey morals and involved with morals and religion and, you know, storytelling and all these parental functions, trying to basically usurp parental roles and then inject their own memes into people that serve Jewish interests and are, you know, frequently
those would be parasitic memes.
Well, they're memes. I would say they're virulent. I mean, they're memes that you know, like a virus. In fact, Dawkins wrote about memes basically being mind viruses. So, you know, the Bible and Hollywood and, you know, academia, all these things are basically about, you know, taking memes and you know, doing things with them. And,
I never really cared for Dawkins.
Well, yeah, that's okay, but the fact of the matter is that there are lots of scientists that I don't care for that have done valid work. Okay, I mean, I'm not saying that...
Oh, yeah, no, Dawkins was always a little bit too popularizing for me.
Yeah, I know, I understand, but, you know, he did two things that were very important. One thing was his construct of the meme, and the other one was the construct of the extended phenotype.
An important concept, yeah.
But in fact, once he did the extended phenotype, by the way, they came after him and it completely neutralized him into this you know, big sort of red herring about going after creationism, basically. And, yeah, atheism, creationism, humanism, that whole thing. You know, basically, he got into a topic that was too hot, which is this whole idea of the extended phenotype, which is essentially, you know, you can, some organisms, especially parasites, can express their phenotypes in other organisms, like, you know, get them to do things like sneeze to, you know, spread them around the way a cold virus.
Or fly into the water.
Yeah, fly into the water so that the parasite can escape out of the abdomen and swim away, et cetera. But once he did that, the book Extended Phenotype, and he admitted that was his best work. You know, he just basically got, I think that attracted something to him and destroyed him. So that was the last time he did anything of value. And it was very valuable, and I think that's why he was destroyed.
You know, James, I think between you and I, or is it between you and me?
Now,
between
let me
you
ask
and
you, while
I,
we're I on that, while we're on that subject, you guys have any thoughts, I mean, in relation to that with what happened to Watson a few weeks ago? The DNA
Framed. He was framed.
What do you mean he was framed? He made the comment.
That poor old guy? Oh, come.
He didn't make the comment? He didn't make the comment?
What? Oh, no, I'm trying to defend him, that's all.
But what do you think about
guy.
Him?
It could be somebody's grandpa.
He was, I guess, the head developer, the head honcho over that DNA research facility. He lost his job. He was over in Europe doing a book tour. They canceled
his... co-discoverer of DNA.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
What is it,
double helix? That's
right,
the guy.
Right. 1962, he wins the Nobel Prize, right, for that.
Right.
And what was his comment? He said the reason why the social programs in Africa don't work is that they are built upon the assumption that blacks have the same intelligence as whites. And that guy's
clearly... Well, he was a little bit more, nuanced than that. He was trying to not state it as fact, but as a potential, as a reasonable hypothesis.
Okay.
And as soon as you accept that as a reasonable hypothesis, then you've opened the can of worms because it's true, okay? And everybody knows that it's true. Just like, when the emperor has no clothes and the kid says, he didn't have any clothes. Well, no, what he ends up, if he's a professor, what he says, well, I hypothesize the emperor has no clothes, okay? And, then, of course, that's just as bad, if not worse, because...
Because everybody knows already.
Right. So basically what happened was that this poor son of a bitch was... I mean, and this happens over and over and over again. I mean, if you go back, and there's lots of examples. What's that? Who's that actor that was in Apocalypse Now?
Mel Gibson?
Anyway.
No.
Martin Sheen.
What?
Martin Sheen.
Martin Sheen, yeah.
No, Martin Sheen, the other guy, the old actor.
Brando.
Brando. You remember when Brando, like did something, said something about Jews? He says basically, Hollywood, it's run by Jews. And one thing you'll never see portrayed is, you'll see the nigger, you'll see the honky, you'll see the redneck, you'll see the spick, you'll never see the kike. That's what he said, right?
Yeah.
And then the next thing you know, he's like kneeling down, kissing the ring of the rabbis around there, okay? And it's always the same thing, and these guys always think that they're going to be able to, say the truth and then, turn around and go, oh, I didn't really mean that, right? And, that's just never works. So, and Watson did that, and he ended up losing his position. He lost everything, except he might have a little bit of publicity for his book, but he was canceled on a lot of his tour. So it's a sad situation. The guy was he's an old guy who was at a stage in life where he didn't feel like he had a lot to lose, and he just wanted to say something very important. And he did it, and then he buckled. He just be the informatives of old age that made him do that. But a lot of people do that, and who are prominent. But it's very sad to watch it.
Well, the frontal lobe goes,
Well, look at him, Mel Gibson, Jimmy Carter, Look at all these guys.
I mean...
Especially Carter. How old was Carter when he put that book out? Was he 80? Is he about 80?
Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And look how he published a book. He published a book with his opinions, and then a month later, he's completely contradicting. They must have threatened his kids.
Yeah, it's really a mystery.
How come nobody threatens me? Is it just because I'm completely obscure and nobody cares what I think?
That would be myself and you included as well. Yeah, we're little people.
Well, one possibility is if you look at Mel Gibson, for example. Okay, he did this like turnabout thing where he said, "Oh well, blah blah blah," I think. A lot of the people.
Well, he was drunk too. I mean, that is a defense, right? I mean, the cop who arrested him said, "Hey, he was drunk." Drunk people say a lot of things. So
yeah,
I mean,
understand. But what I'm trying to say about Mel Gibson is, I mean, he also just there were a lot of things that he said that if you look at other things he said at other times, he can't really back down, but he sort of did anyway. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's this pattern where if you're prominent. And you say something like this. None of us are prominent, okay? But if you're prominent, I think there may be something going on. Like you can't get into a position of prominence without having done something that can be used to blackmail you or something.
Well, wait. So what do you mean not prominent? I was actually covered in the Daily Mirror today. Well, anyway, my mirror. I don't know about yours.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Brother. You're the exception in all respects, Soren. So, but we can't. If we start talking about you, we may as well.
No, actually, there's a reason that probably doesn't apply to, most people like my renowned co-host tonight, but might apply somewhat to you, James, and applies very strongly to me. Another reason besides the fact that I'm totally obscure, which is that even if anybody does listen to me, people aren't quite sure they understand what I'm saying.
fear in their opponents. What's the first thing that they do?
Lawsuit. But the point is, they act that way even to other Jews. They can't help it. It's just the compulsion they're under is not to use it against us. It's just to use it. It's just to act that way. Not to act that way against us, but what they have to do is act like the Jews that they are. And if there's only other Jews around, they'll act like Jews to the other Jews.
All right, maybe it's not the most important story on earth. James Barry, what do you say? What is your opinion on this, sir?
Well, the idea that Jews are sort of randomly targeting this kind of virulent behavior is more or less correct. I think that there are some constraints on it, especially, in fact, I think Judaism itself may be in part set up specifically to try to contain some of this stuff within the Jewish community. And then when you get guys going outside the Jewish community, they start doing things like, you know, creating Freudianism and, you know, Boasianism and Frankfurt School and all the cultural critique stuff. And like I said, that gets into this whole thing I was saying about alloparenting and basically, you know, being in a parental ego state toward everybody. And, you know, then imposing these irrational morals that destroy people on a population that can ill afford to be given bad morals because they have such a moral integrity as our people do. So it's a very deadly thing.
Well, speak for yourself, James. It's been hard, but I've conquered it in myself.
You've conquered what?
The whole moral thing.
The whole moral thing? Yeah. I think that you may think you've conquered it, okay?
Acting in a way that my conscience disapproved of used to stick in my craw, so I had it surgically removed.
I like that, yeah. We've got several reports here, a lot of comments coming in on the Skype chat. About the quality of tonight's show. A lot of comments about James Barry and his commentary. Very favorable. So listeners are happy with what they're hearing out there. So getting back to this story, I love Jewish fraud stories more than anything else. It's probably my favorite story to report on. If you took the dollar amounts of all the Jewish fraud that we've reported this year, we're probably up to $1 trillion. Every single story, these are not, you got to hand it to the Jews. When they steal big. It's not, what was that other story, $7.6 million? Well, this one is $8 million. And going off the show list that you guys have, let me just pull that up real quick. This is New York investment advisor arrested on fraud charges. Okay, and this is coming to us from Reuters. A New York investment advisor was arrested on fraud charges on Wednesday for his alleged role in investment schemes that led to more than $8 million in losses, U.S. prosecutors said. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan said Chaim Regensburg, president of Arbco Capital Management, LLP, and Midwest Trading, LLC, had given some of the investor money to relatives and also lost portions of the funds in speculative options trading. Regensburg, age 43, paid some of the money he took from new investors to older investors as profits, thus perpetuating a Ponzi scheme, prosecutors said. Regensburg promised to invest money in two ways, they said. In one plan, he said he would invest the money in either international initial public offerings or pre-IPO stock, claiming he had contacts that enabled him to sell the investment product earlier than others in the market. And the other, he said he would pool investors' money and give it to a trading institutions as short-term loans, prosecutors said. Regensburg, who was arrested with the help of FBI agents, is charged with one count of securities fraud and one count of wire fraud. He faces a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison on each count, prosecutors said. Now, how is it that this guy only had two actual charges filed against him? Was it $8 million in fraud here or $8 million in losses? How many clients did he have? Only one. Only one client? How many people did he dupe? Why are we only seeing two charges here? Why are we not seeing 20 charges on each count? 20 charges of wire fraud. This guy only duped one person? Is that what they're trying to tell you? or every single case that he perpetuated against his quote-unquote clients was only counted as one charge. The level of fraud with these people, circumventing the system here, I reported a lot with these funds being funneled to family members, or they're funneled into some Israeli company where the money is then gone. It's collected over in Israel. These people can't be extradited back to the U.S. My guess is going to be what you're going to see with these guys. A lot of these guys walk away with $2, $3, or $4 million in fraud. They only wind up serving 2 years in prison. Now, who wouldn't take that kind of deal? You have to hand it to the Jews. When they steal big. And for these kinds of white-collar crimes, these guys are getting 1 year, 2 year. Some of these guys are getting, with the welfare fraud, $600,000 in welfare fraud or something, and they're getting probation.
Yeah, I've actually run across a situation where a second cousin of Leon Trotsky, Leon Bronstein, you know, the origin of the Bolsheviks. He got his tuition paid to Columbia by Meyer Lansky. So this guy was connected in the New York City fraud scene. And he basically said it is known that what you're supposed to do if you're going to commit fraud is you try to do the biggest job that you can. Don't try to do a bunch of little things. Do one big job. It's an explicit rule. It's not like, you know, oh, well, I just do this naturally. It's like, you know, maybe to do it naturally. But it's also a rule by Machiavelli that he talks about. You know, basically he says, well, look, if you're going to go and you have to do something really nasty to the people, you know, or there are a number of things you have to do that are nasty, just do one thing. Just do one really nasty thing and then dole out, you know, small favors over a period of time, because people, you know, they have difficulty keeping things in perspective. It's like they've got some kind of a limit on their perception. So they can't really rationally consider just horrendous crime. It's sort of like the big lie theory that Hitler wrote about in Mein Kampf. It basically, you know, said that the bigger the lie, the more effective it is. And nobody knows that better than the Jews, who are the master of the lies, according to Schopenhauer. And so the mechanism that you're playing on here is that people have difficulty thinking quantitatively or rationally in terms of ratios, which is the root word of rational. They have difficulty keeping things in perspective, especially when they have really big numbers involved. And the same principle applies to things like trauma. If you can do something to somebody and it's extremely traumatic, sometimes they don't even remember it. You know, and I think that a lot of what's happened over the last generation to our people has just been in that form. It's been this like enormous, multidimensional, you know, tragedy that has hit us in ways that you know, if it was normal war, it would be less adapted to that.
Wait a second. You
know, yeah,
James. Trauma that one doesn't remember. This sounds like did you remember Whitley Strieber's book Communion? You know, like the alien, the UFOs taking him away, but he like lost memory for those instants when he was being.
Yeah, I understand. There are lots of theories about, you know, the relationship between that stuff and maybe the government doing covert stuff. But there's much more mundane things are understood to exhibit this kind of amnesia or inability to adequately process whatever the information is that's coming in. So, you know, I mean, post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, I think that there's a real phenomenon there where people may experience they're just overloaded, and that puts them into a state where they don't actually learn from the experience. They can't actually put things in perspective. And so if you go out and you commit a crime that's horrendous enough, then what ends up happening is that people just don't react rationally to it, and you can get away with it. So I think there's been a lot of that going on. I mean, this thing that happened to our people in the United States especially, but in Euro people in general over the last generation, where, you know, we went from, you know, a relatively sane, you know, reproductively viable situation to, you know, the sexual revolution and the drugs and the inflation and property values going out over the roof, and then women going into the workplace and, you know, gays and, you know, all this stuff, all, you know, an invasion of foreign people into our areas, and then, you know, we can't keep control of our own communities and their constitution, you know, all at once. And, you know, doing that not only creates confusion that you can't possibly, so you can't possibly sort out what's causing what, but it also creates trauma so you can't really learn and adapt appropriately. And so, yeah, you end up with people who are acting hysterically, and you end up with people who, you know, act as, you know, in quote, extreme, in quote, ways, and, well, what the hell else are they going to do, you know? I mean, with that kind of shit going on. So, yeah, I think that this kind of stuff where you've got these guys, you know, committing these you know, very large, you know, single-point fraud things is part of a larger pattern of the way virulent organisms evolve to exploit the design limits of their victims so that their victims, you know, can't really adapt or learn, and they're just, you know, basically collapse in the face of the enormity of the crime.
Very valid points. Yeah. I think you're right. As far as it being an explicit point with them, that if you're going to commit this kind of fraud, white-collar crime here, go all out for one shot. Don't do a bunch of little crimes, but walk away with a $10 million paycheck. Hope you get away with it. And if you do get caught, well, you'll probably do 2 years in a minimum security prison, and then you'll be out. And when you get out, your relatives, your aunt, your Uncle Shlomo over in Israel, that money that got funneled to him, well, it's sitting there waiting for you.
But the thing is, even if you get killed, if you look at the numbers that involve these kinds of things, okay, for example, let's take the actuarial value on a human life. I don't know, but when I studied this stuff, I was doing public policy back in around 1990, and, you know, there were these actuarial figures on the order of $1 million per human life that people were using. I mean, these days it's probably much higher than that because of inflation and stuff, but let's say it's $5 million, okay?
Okay.
What you're doing when you walk away with $1 billion, okay, is you're walking away with the equivalent of something like 200, how many lives would that be? It's like, you know, 200 lives. You've taken 200 lives, okay, is one way to think of it. If you get a bunch of people doing stuff like that, committing crimes in that order of financial fraud, then, you know, you can have a whole bunch of them. You can get 1 in 200. I mean, you know, actually, I have only one in 200 getting away with it, and you're still sort of breaking even in terms of warfare, in terms of kill ratio. So, you know, I think that you know, focusing on the fact that these guys might get a small sentence is really, you know, beside the point in terms of the group dynamics that are at work here. Okay, you walk away with $1 billion, and that somehow goes into the community with ethnic nepotism. You've just gained a huge advantage, even if you have a relatively high kill rate on the people who are committing those kinds of crimes. So, you know, it's the kind of thing where you really have to treat this much more seriously than just like, oh, okay, this guy got a slap on the wrist, right? It's an ecological disaster is what it is. And you have to be able to figure out some way to contain it. And this is one of the reasons why this whole thing about freedom of association is so critical. Because, you know, if you have firewalls to prevent people from grabbing a bunch of gold and then going into a different area and then doing it all over again and then going in a different area and doing it all over again, which is in evolutionary medicine, that's called horizontal transmission. And it evolves the most virulent of viruses and parasites. This kind of, you know, internationalism or inter-ecological transportation is exactly what's characterized the evolution of the Jew over thousands of years. So that if we can contain, that's one of the reasons I actually tell people I'm a Zionist. I believe that it's important that Israel really exists and that Jews go there so that they can exist within their own human ecology and start to learn what it's like to be subjected to Jews. If we can get that, if we can get Israel serving that function, then, you know, I think that there's a lot to be gained from that. And in fact, Israel right now is already demonstrating a lot of the characteristics of that. There are a lot of aspects of Israel that are obviously very, you know, bringing down the wrath of the world because of it's a virulent behavior in a lot of ways. But, you know, there are things that you know, there remains to be done, like if you have dual citizenship, and obviously everybody who's a Jew that is a citizen of Israel should immediately be deported to Israel. And there's no excuse for
but
that.
Aren't all Jews citizens of Israel?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I mean, if this dual loyalty stuff, if you can demonstrate dual loyalty, then, you know, just by the simple, I'm talking about just by the rules of the current regime, you know, it's like, well, you know, really, where do they belong? And if they've got these,
have you heard this defense against, for instance, Mearsheimer and Waltz thesis? The defense: well, sure, there's an Israel lobby, American Jews lobby for Israel, but you know what? American Tibetans lobby for the interests of Tibetans against China. And have you heard this one?
No. Well, I mean,
Christopher Hitchens. I think I heard Danny Postal like coming up with this argument.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know.
Yeah. So why wasn't
you're,
the US
you're coming up? You have this
China.
Brilliant disquisition, right? You have this brilliant disquisition. All I can do is interject with a joke that somebody wrote on the comment thread, and then I'll let you go back to being brilliant.
I'm actually quite sympathetic with the Tibetans. You know, they're a Highland people, and a lot of our people are Highland people that have had this imposition of a human ecology against them. And, you know, they had to leave and go someplace else, but they're not, you know, parasitic people. You know, they don't go around, you know, just doing things to other people as a matter of their adaptation. You know, if they were, then they might be able to get the United States to go and invade China the way the Jews have gotten the United States to go and invade Iraq and now possibly Iran and spend how many boys' lives and legs and, you know, all the rest of it. You know, of course, there's no comparison at all. You know.
We have a comment here from one of the posters who acknowledges you, making a very good point with the Jews, but unfortunately, he's indicating the opinion, which more or less he's correct. They're nomads. The Jews, their thirst for power, their bloodthirst for power, they're not going to go quietly and go sit in the Middle East. The Jews' reach is always trying to basically take over the planet, really.
Well, yeah, I understand. And one of the reasons why the libertarianism is so important, and one of the reasons they're focused on taking control of it, is that the primary rule of libertarianism is freedom of association. And that's the one thing Jews can't tolerate. Okay? In fact, that's the one thing that any kind of what I call a vectorist organism can't tolerate. They can't tolerate any exclusion from anywhere. Because as soon as you exclude them from anywhere, that place might demonstrate that they're actually parasites by exhibiting health. And then you have some way of comparing. In other words, you have a control group that isn't subjected to this experiment. In fact, I think that was one of the things that Hitler said, was that one of the greatest crimes in the Jewish eye of the Nazi regime was that they demonstrated that what the German people were capable of economically if the Jews were excluded. And, of course, you know, Jews would say, well, they stole out of Guelph and blah, blah, blah. But the point is that, you know.
James, did you read the New Yorker last week?
No.
A week or two ago, they had a big story. I profiled this man named Sam Zell, who's a billionaire Chicago real estate developer and a Jew, who's worth like $5 billion or something. But he bought the Chicago Tribune Company this year or last year. And there's a big article about him. And in the middle of it, he says something about having assets in different countries in case he has to flee the country. Because he's like, you know, in 1929 or so, the Jews were doing better in Germany than in any other country in the world. They were, like, in control. They were in control of the money. And, you know, a few years later, they were building camps and, like, you know, persecuting us. And, you know, when it could happen here just that quickly. And I thought it was really interesting, you know, like, yeah, they do think about that all the time.
Well, they don't really think about what the real dynamics are. The real dynamics are there's a ecological cycle where they come into an area, and really the cycle starts more or less with the gold. Okay, so you get a few guys save, like, during the expulsion of the Jews out of Spain. Okay, they take off and they go into Holland. But what a lot of people don't know is they also went into Great Britain at the same time and got into Henry VII's court. And the way they do it, the way they penetrate these courts, even when they're excluded from places like England, is they come in with a lot of gold. And that's where it starts. And they go straight to the top. And they start corrupting things in such a way that the middle class, or what in that era was called the yeoman class, starts being cleared off the land so that they are become dependent on the mercantile forces rather than being independent and having a source of food and housing themselves where they can have children. And once you do that, then you can now start to re-centralize wealth into the new human ecology. And once you've got wealth sufficiently centralized, again, you turn it into gold and take off to the next one. And of course, you leave a lot of your folks behind to take the heat, and then they go, "Oh, look what they did to us, they're terrible people, and oh, we need to come in here. We're innocent victims, just like Jesus. Here's our gold, and let us like do it again."
Well, if that's true, then they're really in you know what a coffin corner is? It's when you go base jumping with a single parachute and you pull it and it doesn't work. That right there is a coffin corner. Okay, it's an unrecoverable situation. And the Jews, it looks like they're in a coffin corner because there isn't any place to flee to now. There isn't any place to, like...
Oh, no, they actually had an open conference where they talked about the future of Jews, given the fact that the West looks like it might collapse, and they're explicitly talking about Asia. I
wonder how much luck they think they'll have in China. Are the closest thing, the Chinese in other countries in Asia are a market-dominant minority, and they're the closest thing to a people as unpopular as the Jews.
Right.
I'm just saying,
Jews have not co-evolved with the Chinese, and so they don't have an instinctive awareness of the danger. So, I mean, they co-evolved with human, with Europe, Europeans. As long as they were going between European nations, then they could play the same game over and over and over again unconsciously, pretty much. And I really do think it's unconscious and instinctive. It's just a group organism thing that's going on. And so what happens is that, and they have some degree of conscious thought about, you know, certain levels of the stuff. They don't actually think, okay, well, what we're going to do is, like, you know, imitate a horizontally transmitted virus and evolve virulence and destroy all these nations. That's not what, they aren't thinking that. They're just thinking about things at the level that you talked about, or on the level that this Jewish conference had in Israel, which is, oh, well, we're having problems and we might have to go someplace. And so how do we get it, you know, arrange for that? So at this point, yeah, they don't know what kind of trouble they're in, really.
That would put them in the same boat with, like, everybody else, because I have noticed that very few people seem to actually understand how bad the situation we're in on so many levels is. And tonight is not the night to discuss that.
Yeah, well, you know, this gets into the whole Malthusian versus Kornikovian thing. And, you know, we're really at a crisis point, and it could
VNN now, and we're at VNN now. We're talking to a lot of very clever white Americans, but I would bet that less than 50% of them know what Malthusianism is, and I think the numbers on Kornikovianism would be lower than.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's real simply. Malthusianism is, you know, you have a certain amount of food that you can produce per acre of land. And there's so many acres of land, and then there's so many people, and then you have a limit, and you can't really, for whatever reason, expand that food production. You can't expand the food, you can't expand the land, or you can't expand the rate at which you produce food on the land. And that population limit is what Malthus and a lot of the old economists talked about a lot. Now, there are lots of things that have happened since then involving science and technology, industrial revolution, that have discredited some of the predictions of the Malthusians. But the thing is that if you have the ability to continue to do that kind of stuff so that genuinely inventive people are in control of capital, then, yeah, maybe you can avert the Malthusian wall, avert the Malthusian confrontation. The problem that we have is that the inventive people have had their capital hijacked. And now you've got people who know how to grab control of stuff, but they don't know how to really create stuff. And in that situation, it's, you know, that's what's bringing us to the brink. And so at the present point in time, it's really, you know, touch and go as to whether there's going to be enough creative force allowed to be able to avoid an absolute Malthusian collapse into what ultimately it turns into a race war. If you can even have a structure as large as a race, it could just be, you know, random violence all over the place and complete, you know, the chaos. It's unclear, you know, and when you're talking about that kind of stuff, it's unclear what's preferable, you know, because we're in a situation where it's a very different world from the one in which we live right now.
Did you cover cornucopianism yet?
No, well, I didn't talk. I mean, cornucopianism basically is, you know, if you have inventive people able to retain the fruits of their invention, then they can further invent their way out of limits. And we were on the verge of getting into space and becoming heliocentric. I mean, there's a huge space out there that could support trillions of people if, you know, we were set free. But instead, the 1960s had this other thing going on called the counterculture and all these horrendous things that happened in multi-dimensions all at once and created this huge trauma, and all of a sudden, bingo, we're, like, stopped. And the best any of the engineers can do is push bits around. So,
James?
You know,
James, what's the difference between a cornucopia and Michael Jackson at a boy's sleepover?
Oh, Lord.
What's the difference between a cornucopia and Michael Jackson at a boy's sleepover?
No clue.
Well, a cornucopia is a horn of plenty.
Oh, God. And you know what? On that note, with that horrendous, horrible joke, we're going to take a break. We're going to be back in about 10 minutes.
Won't interfere with anybody else. Okay, well, this is from Goldman Sachs, this story.
Correct.
And Goldman Sachs, as you know, is the largest bank in the world, right? They're this investment bank, and they take big risks, and they play with their own money. Anyway, this is a story about an encounter I had at a day-long barbecue, a party, but I wasn't drinking. I think I had 3 beers the whole day. My wife and I and our daughter went to Ivan's house in 2001, around 4th of July, and during the party, I met this friend of Ivan, whom I had heard of, named Haim, who's Jewish, and who was in his early 30s at the time, or mid-30s, and was a vice president at Goldman Sachs. I mean, he was, like, on the career path. I think at the time he was actually a vice president. And I met him at this party, and I had actually been told, Haim wants to meet you. And he was sitting at this table, and I walked up, and he's like, yeah, man, I've been wanting to talk to you. So what does this vice president at Goldman Sachs want to talk to me about? He says, sit down. Listen, I have a question for you. Suppose that a man needed to become the greatest orator in the world, in the history of the world, and he had to develop this talent and practice somehow so that he knew that he had it, he had the chops, but he couldn't be public about the fact that he was practicing. How would he go about it? So I talked to him, and he seemed real intense, real crazy. And I talked to him about it, and it turned out, of course, that what he was talking about was becoming the Antichrist. So that's my story about Goldman Sachs, that I met a vice president of Goldman Sachs, and he was actually a Jew who was actually interested in how one goes about becoming the Antichrist. He explained to me, you don't understand, the Antichrist isn't like a person like Jesus, like he's born to be Jesus. The Antichrist is like a position. You, like, run for it. You compete for it. Very strange. And these are the people that are running the world economy. That's all I got.
Okay.
Well, James, one of the things I'd like to sort of interject this, and go back to something I was saying earlier about this life cycle of the Jewish organism, where gold plays a key part in it, specifically in the migratory phase. Right now, what we're seeing in all this chaos is a surge in the price of gold and other precious metals. So the question is, well, there's a lot of demand for gold, and you hear stuff like, oh, it's just the gold peddlers pushing their wares, and or people in general are kind of getting panicky, etc. Do we really know where the actual physical gold is going, and who has physical control of it? The reason I ask this question is because I think that this, like I said, I think that historically this has been a way of taking concentrated wealth, which is one of the key extended phenotypes of the Jewish organism, is to concentrate wealth, whether it's in the hands of capitalist central bankers or in the hands of a Stalinist central state, a communist central planning state. You centralize control of assets. And then, when things fall apart, whether it's during Glasnost and you get the oligarchs running off with all the natural resources, or, other times in history, you get some ability to centralize wealth to the point that the population is completely dispossessed, basically.
James,
yeah?
How does that relate to the damn, like the FBI going into the invading and seizing the damn Liberty dollars?
Well,
that happened yesterday. I mean, let's think about that.
Yeah, I understand. I want to first of all put a little bit of a nuance. Fundamentally, I think that's part of the gig is gold in this kind of situation at this stage in the life cycle becomes sort of a, you have to think about it like a critical resource for the organism.
Wait, James, okay? When you say life cycle, are you talking about any of that Kondratiev stuff? Like the Kondratiev wave?
No.
Okay.
Well, I don't relate it to that necessarily, but, there would be a cycle here that might be measurable in some kind of economic, econometric sense, but what I'm trying to get at is something that's more organic, okay? There's something that goes on where wealth is centralized, the yeoman class, the people are dispossessed of their land, they're forced into these wage slave jobs in the cities, and they're exploited to a point where things start falling apart socially. And then you get enough centralized wealth, and it doesn't really matter to first order in whose hands the wealth is centralized. It can be in the hands of an indigenous elite. That's fine. The point is that once it's centralized, it's easy to grab it and then take off with it over the border, okay? And then once that happens and you go, then, of course, everybody is pissed off in the old country where you're leaving, and they start victimizing Jews because they've done all this stuff. But then a bunch of other Jews take off, and then, the guys who take off say, oh, look what they're doing to us Jews, right? And, of course, they may be even a minority of the Jews that take off and do this, but the point is that they continue the cycle and they create a new stage of evolution of virulence, because that what you're selecting for in that process are the most virulent and fraud-prone of the Jews that take off with this wealth over the border. So I think what we're seeing right now with this coinage being confiscated by the FBI, and I think it was the Secret Service, but I don't think the Treasury was involved, it is probably trying to make it so that people don't actually have an alternative to the currency that's going to be undergoing hyperinflation. And like in the Weimar era, you had hyperinflation that was just horrendous. And that led up to the Nazi Party, the rise of the Nazi Party, and I think we're, and then of course the escape of wealthy Jews, and then the Jews who weren't so wealthy were either subjected to the transfer agreement to get into Israel, or they were stuck working in the factories, etc. And we're seeing a situation, don't forget, James.
That the Jews that were left got bombed by the Allies, so that's important to state. I mean the. Of the 240,000 Jews that died during the Holocaust, or Holocaust, whatever, the majority of them died during the Allied bombing. So
I'm not trying. I'm not trying to talk about Christianity and that whole thing here. What I'm talking about is that there's this the really nasty thing that occurs is when the centralized wealth is absconded with and then transported over the border away from the people, and the people are left to try to make do, and you know they have to resort to things like Nazism to be able to survive. And it turns out that, you know, in that system, they're actually much better off than they were, because the situation that they were experiencing was this like intense parasitism. But this goes on over and over again. I think what we're seeing now is we're seeing a stage very similar to the Weimar situation, where you have hyperinflation on the horizon and gold is being absconded with, the state is being brought to bear to make it so that people who are not really powerful enough or authorized in some sense to possess gold are dispossessed of it.
James, may I interrupt? So you agree then that Bernanke and the others are absolutely committed toward not permitting deflation, so they'll permit hyperinflation before deflation?
Well, they're
so the market,
I wrote it's going to crash up. What's that?
The market's going to crash up, in other words, with the dollar continuing to drop and the market maybe not crashing numerically.
Well, the hyperinflation doesn't solve the problem when you're in this kind of state. I mean, the Weimar situation under hyperinflation, the economy was shit, okay? And what we're going to see, and I wrote about this over a year ago, I basically predicted that we'd see the first signs of hyperinflation starting about now. And indeed we are, and the conditions that I predicted would occur is that people who, you know, basically the middle class are being deprived of the ability to be able to get enough home equity to really reproduce effectively. They're having to have abortions and stuff to maintain control of the finances if they're going to be, quote, responsible, unquote. And then what happens is they have to start borrowing against their equity just to live. There's a lot of consumerism that's you know part and parcel of the pathological
that's known
society.
As eating your seed corn.
Yeah, and so people end up eating into their home equity, and there's some point at which they run out, and the system is not providing them with sufficient wages to be able to have families, and then they run out of the home equity that was propped up by the low interest rates, and that's the point at which they're all tapped out on credit, and the consumer base collapses. Now, when you have a consumer base collapse, in other words, you don't have demand for any goods or services, well, there's no point in investing in anything because of the fact that, like, there's no demand for any of the things that you might invest in. So then you have a demand, you have an investment collapse that starts to take place. Well, in that kind of situation where you don't have enough consumer strength to create a demand to drive the investment, the central wealth forces start going, well, you know, now what am I going to do?
This past year, and said, yeah, well, it was our fault, we caused the 1920 collapse. He wiped his hands of it. And now the same goddamn thing is happening.
In this situation, though, the fundamentals of the economy are worse in this situation because in the 1930s...
It's not just worse, though, James. It's like 10 times worse. Because all the people that they're going to get...
Hey, Mark, hold on a second.
On
Mark.
...are all a bunch of blacks and spics.
Mark, hold
all
on a second.
All the people that are going to go out there and rob and murder and kill our people are the ones that they're going to throw out on the streets. It's not white people. It's not the bread lines. It's not the white bread lines of the 1920s anymore. This is what's pissing me off right now. And people don't get that. Have I lost my mind, or do you guys agree?
James,
That's one of the ways that it's worse. Another way that it's worse is that we don't have the fundamental character on our own people to be able to do things like build machine tools or have a manufacturing base. I mean, you have to remember in the 1930s, we had guys like Howard Hughes going out there and building an airline industry, okay? And we'd just gotten through having Lindbergh take off across the ocean in 1927. There were a variety of things that were, you know, had some fundamental strengths that could be brought to bear by the entry of the U.S. into World War II, so that you could start pumping money back into the people. that had been centralized away from them. And now we don't really have that strength. There's nothing really to fall back on. They've made it so that they've destroyed the middle-class technical class, tried to replace them with people from India who have their own. I mean, basically, if you want to look at where a lot of the gold's going, I was in Silicon Valley watching it personally, physically happen at the gold exchanges there. There's like Indian guys walking in, walking out with gold and taking in 747 loads and the limit back to India. And this is one of the things that I think is a bit different.
Well,
this
hold on.
Around.
Can you sit back? You saw that happen?
Yeah.
Please explain.
Well, I mean, it's no great, you know, secret. Basically, one of the things that Indians do is they load their wives up with lots of gold jewelry. And it's sort of a way of creating a sense of security for their wives. And I suppose it's some kind of thing having to do with fertility and helps them have kids more effectively or something. But the point is that when they were making money by taking the jobs that would have gone to us in Silicon Valley, they would take a lot of that cash, much of which they would save by living in very high-density situations in Silicon Valley and doing nothing to seek out a mate or doing anything that would distract from saving money. And they go and buy gold at the local gold stores. And they talk about it. They take the limit. I can't remember what the limit was, but it was common knowledge that every time a guy from India would fly from Silicon Valley back to India, he would be carrying with him the limit of gold that he could carry, and, you know, for other people, if not for himself. So these 747s were just loaded up with the gold to just go and, you know, shipping gold to India every flight.
Yeah, and we allowed that to happen.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say we as in us, but the government that is in place has done that. I mean,
yeah, I think there was a deal that was made sort of between the Jews and the Indians where they would sort of say, well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And the Jews were thinking, well, we've got these Islamics that are enemies, and the Indians are also enemies of the Islamics. And so we'll sort of like sell out the white middle class of the United States to the Indians for alliance with the Indians. And so they allowed them to basically just, you know, walk all over us. Take our technology and our jobs and everything else.
They are not creators as what we are, okay?
And I think a lot of them will admit that. I mean, you know, but you have to hand it to them. You know, they've got some business acumen.
Honestly, though, James, what is business acumen? What does that mean? I mean, that's Jew terminology. It's like, you know what, if I can steal something from somebody else and line my fucking pockets, that's a good thing. That is Jewology. That is what business is.
You know, point taken. And, you know, we can use a different terminology. But my point is that they're coming into a similar ecological niche to the Jews. I mean, first of all, they occupy our niche, and then that means that we can't invent our way out of the Malthusian crisis. And then they proceed on into MBA programs at the expense of the Hewlett-Packard stock owners, for example, which is what I observed. You know, a lot of the Fortune 1000 companies have programs where H-1B employees could get a green card and then go on and get an MBA. And so that was really the path that a lot of these guys were seeking.
Help at some point, right? If they
Soren, let me propose something, okay? And this gets back to the reason that I support Ron Paul. If we can't go out in the current circumstance and sort of take whatever prudent actions are necessary to prepare for the eventualities that you're talking about, which I agree are very real and they're eventualities we need to prepare for, then we really need to get to the point where we could at least establish some kind of freedom of association so that people can choose their associates and enter into some kind of community with people of like mind in a way that allows them to formulate just one state out of many. And once you're in that state, then if there's a Malthusian crisis, and I understand you think that we're in one, I don't see that, but if there is a Malthusian crisis, then there's at least a prayer that you can take that and hold onto some territory, if not fight, and win, if necessary. So my position is, as always, you have to start with the ability to grab, be able to have some territory that you share with other people of like mind, and that can be supported by libertarianism. And that might provide the way out of the Malthusian crisis that you're preparing for. I'm not saying it will. I'm not saying that we have a moral duty to act as though it will. But what I am saying is that regardless of whether it does or not, it's an immediate action that we can take that's a first step to taking prudent action for the future, even if we run into a Malthusian crisis.
But James, Malthusian, whatever the hell it is. I mean, let's think about this. How did the United States secede from England? Was it through discussion? Was it through writings? Was it through poetry? No,
well,
it was through violence. It was through violence.
And you know
what I wanted to say was that before there was a Revolutionary War, there was a Declaration of Independence. And just being able to formulate the Declaration of Independence, just formulate the Declaration, is a really big deal, and it is verbal. It, of course, has to involve organizing in such a way that there are people who are keeping and bearing arms with military intent, but that is the entire point of the Second Amendment, in the United States at least. So there is that at least consolation. And with that basis, there's the basis to go ahead and organize militarily, which is really our duty as members of the citizen militia, and then go ahead and make whatever declarations are necessary to create the kind of state that, in our judgment, will best affect our welfare and safety. And that's directly in the Declaration of Independence, those very words. So the foundation of this country is built upon the idea that there will come a point in time when, you know, the people will say, we want to have a different government, and we deserve to have a different government on our own territory. That means land. And these are the principles upon which we want to found that. So I think it's reasonable to talk about what those principles are, with an eye toward becoming prepared militarily.